All right. I am Lillian Wilson, and I'm meeting with Thomas Brunk at the Freer House at 71 East Ferry Street in Detroit. And today's date is October 20th, 2014, and it is exactly 2:30 p.m. Okay, so you first visited the Freer House in your early 20s.
Yes.
Okay. And could you talk about that experience a little bit?
Well, then it was owned by Merrill Palmer, not Wayne State University. And there were still people here who had been around since almost the beginning. Mm-hmm. So they were keenly aware of Freer and his life and valued the house,
okay,
which was a whole different institutional mentality than Wayne State brought when they acquired it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an old house.
Okay.
So they had this connection, which they continued on. About a year later, I became involved in their preservation committee, or a committee that we started to work on preserving the house and interpreting it. There was no real program for that.
Okay.
There was a lot of interest, but nothing had really happened about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that later grew to Friends of Freer House.
Right.
So,
which you're now the president of?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of my impression, of course, my keen interest was Freer's relationship with Powabic pottery,
right,
which brought me here, and the architectural interest, because I was president of the Society of Architectural Historians at the time. So there were two interests simultaneous.
Mm-hmm.
There were offices primarily being used here. So not everything was readily available to see. And it takes a while, as you know, to kind of get a grasp mentally of what's here.
Yeah.
It's a complicated house.
It is.
So there were a number of issues. I made several visits back.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Powabic fireplace and the Hubler Lounge, which was installed in 1911, is a keen one.
Mm-hmm.
And then I knew Ella Peters, Mrs. Stratton's assistant, who glazed the iridescent fireplace in the Peacock Room in 1961 for Merrill Palmer.
So what is currently the Peacock Room in this house in Detroit?
Yes.
Okay. So what exists in the other room right across the hall?
You mean across the courtyard?
That's right, across the courtyard, yeah.
Yes, the fireplace is there.
Okay. And then the original from Whistler's Peacock Room is in Washington.
Yes.
So she essentially remade it in the 60s,
right,
many years after
Which
Freer.
Which indicates Merrill Palmer's interest in preserving the thing. There's already one Powabic fireplace,
mm-hmm,
so they wanted to reiterate that.
Right.
Because they were redoing that whole room as a library. It was really very nice,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And which got trashed when Wayne acquired the place.
Sure. Where is the other Powabic fireplace?
In the Hoopler Gallery.
In the Hoopler Gallery upstairs.
That's the one that Freer installed when he built the gallery.
Right, okay. So you and Freer both shared an interest in Powabic pottery.
Yes.
And ceramics.
Yes.
Asian ceramics, Japanese ceramics.
Yes.
So do you think that your interest in, what came first for you, the interest in the Japanese ceramics or the interest in the Powabic pottery?
Powabic pottery primarily through its architectural applications.
Mm-hmm.
And then I became more interested in it. And
right.
Later in 1979, was a founding member of this Powabic Society.
Right.
So.
And then for Freer, having living in Detroit around the time of his first trip to Asia, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
He was already aware of and interested in Powabic pottery, had the fireplace built, like you said, upstairs in the gallery. And do you think that that had an impact on his aesthetic in terms of collecting Asian art?
Well, I think what needs to be understood is, mm-hmm, the relationship that Freer had with Mary Chase Perry and Horace Calkins, which was a symbiotic relationship. I mean, he had glaze chemists whom he could discuss how ancient pieces of ceramics might have been made. And so there was a sharing in that. Perry already had, before she probably even became acquainted with Freer, a knowledge of Asian pottery, which influenced her, because in 1901 she writes about ancient Korean ware.
Oh, okay.
Which is pretty sophisticated.
Yeah, sure.
For that period. But,
that's right.
And Freer really begins buying art pottery by 1894, possibly a little earlier, but we don't have really his purchase records until 1894.
Okay.
So.
Even though he was a master double entry bookkeeper.
Yes. But then he went into a ledger system which Hecker also used.
Okay, right.
And those Hecker records have all been trashed. So.
How did they come to be trashed? Just turnover?
His children.
Oh, his children.
No,
okay.
Ledger books aren't too interesting for most people.
That's right. But important if we were to have them and to know these questions, the answers to these questions, rather. Okay, so when did you first visit the Freer Gallery in Washington, D.C.?
I think it was 1976. And as I told you before, when I got there, Mrs. Smith, who was a librarian, I was pretty young and had the audacity to ask if Dr. Pope was in, and he was the director, and she's like, how dare you ask that question? And I gave her my card and asked her to deliver it to Dr. Pope, which she did.
Sure.
And she came back a little surprised because he had invited me to lunch.
Right.
And at that time, there was a lunchroom in the Freer Gallery for the director, and in that room was the Peacock Room table.
Wow.
So that's where we had lunch and talked about it. I knew his family and all about them, so...
Okay.
I mean, it was kind of an interesting conversation.
Sure.
But, again, he knew Freer, so, I mean, there was a lot of Detroit connections when the Freer Gallery opened. As I said, Joseph Stevens Waring and his son Charles installed the collection in Washington.
Right.
So
Pope was appointed by Freer?
No, he became director later on.
Okay.
He was a Chinese scholar, and blue and white porcelain were his primary interests.
Okay, like Ming Dynasty
porcelain,
okay. And was he on the original board of trustees appointed by Freer?
No,
okay. Because that might have been a conflict of interest, right. I imagine. Okay, so why do you think that he invited you to lunch?
Well, he wanted to find out who this Detroit person was, I'm sure.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And you're still in your 20s at that point.
Yes.
So a young man, yeah. And do you remember, like, learning anything in particular about Freer at that point from him? Or did you teach him anything that maybe he didn't know about Freer?
Well, I think he was surprised because I knew which house he was born in and which year. And I said, you know, it's on the next street from where I live today. Which kind of surprised him. And
sure.
He said, Albert Kahn was the architect for your parents' house. So I think he was a little flummoxed by all that I knew about his family.
Yeah, your wealth of knowledge. And he was born in Detroit. Pope was born in Detroit.
1906.
Interesting. Okay, and then went to Washington, was appointed director.
I'm not sure which year. I want to say maybe in the 40s, late 40s.
So he had been at the there for many, many years then, 30, 40 years by the time you, this young scholar, came and had an interest in Freer. Huh, okay.
And at that time, Freer's vouchers and all of those things were in the same metal boxes that came out of his safe.
My goodness.
So no one had really been through much of that material at all. Today, that, of course, has all been changed. But
right, and it's all in the archives at the Freer Gallery now. Did he let you see any of those things?
Oh, yes.
Oh, he did?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Librarian brought them out. And
right. And what was her name again?
Mrs. Smith. Priscilla Smith.
So, okay. So she must have been surprised, too, by you coming in and knowing so much, huh?
It's interesting how paradigms affect people's decisions because sure. there are things, and she would show me on this thing, and she said, you see, that's junk, so it meant. And I thought, well, no, that's JMK for your secretary, Kennedy. So not junk at all. There's initials that means he posted the information.
Right, okay.
So
little tiny things that, you know, you had a knowledge of that to the average person, even somebody working that closely with the archives, just might not have known.
Well, she had no idea who Kennedy was.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
So it was, she didn't like me correcting her.
No, I bet not. I bet not.
But I said, you might want to be careful about that.
That's right.
Because you know it's not junk.
Junk. Okay. Very funny. Okay. And how long did you spend that particular trip in D.C.?
I think probably 5 days at the Freer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And did you see Pope again after that?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So you were friends with Grace Waring, who was mm-hmm. Joseph Stevens Waring's daughter.
First child.
And he had 3 children?
5.
Oh, 5. Okay. So him and his oldest son were the ones that took the collection to Washington?
Yes.
We have our family tree.
His oldest son, yes. Mm-hmm. So there were 2 girls and then Charles.
Okay.
So Charles would have been...
Mm-hmm.
18 years old.
Okay.
19 years old when Freer died.
Okay.
Actually, 17.
Right, in 1919.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
So in 22, 23, you know, he's going to be another 4 years old. So
that's
21
right.
21 years old.
Okay. So all the children were born in this house?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. All 5 children. Okay. So you were friends with Grace.
Yes.
And you met her... she was a neighbor of yours, is that right? Can you talk about how you came to know her?
Tracking people down, and I found the 1940 census. And,
oh, okay.
And then I went through city directories and found that she was living in the Alden Park Manor just down the street from me.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote her a letter, and
It
was interesting. My friend Susan Hobbs, who was first curator of American art at the Freer.
Okay, yeah.
I was here in Detroit as a guest and had communicated with Grace that she would be here, and Grace invited her to her apartment before I did. When she came back, she said, well, it's filled with Freer stuff.
Wow. And this was at Alden Park in Indian Village, is that
mm-hmm.
right? Okay. Yeah. And you currently live in Indian Village.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So she was a neighbor of yours, and you visited the Freer Gallery with her.
Yes.
Her first visit, around 1990?
Well, I think she may have been there before.
Okay.
But she was supposed to go to work at the Freer Gallery.
Oh.
But her mother would have nothing to do with a young woman going to Washington on her own.
Okay.
So that didn't happen. But,
okay. Okay.
Let's see, I think
but
probably was about... 90, I think it was 1991 that we went to Washington.
Okay.
And already Freer, Grace would have been 90 years old.
Yeah.
So it was like taking a dinosaur to the Smithsonian because no one believed there was anyone alive that knew Freer.
Right.
Let alone actually worked for Freer.
And was born in his house.
And was born in his house.
Grew up in his house.
And as we went... walked around the thing. She would talk about the paintings and where they were at in the house.
Unbelievable, and, yeah.
So they had a reporter or a photographer following us around.
Oh.
Documenting a visit.
The Washington Post or?
No, the Smithsonian photographer.
Oh, the Smithsonian photographer. Okay. Does anything in particular stand out to you or anything that really stood out to her during that trip visiting?
Well, this painting of the children was one of her favorites.
And that's above the staircase, I believe, that connects the Freer and the Sackler today. Yes. So it was still there at that time?
Yes.
Okay. So that was a favorite of hers?
Yes.
Okay. Anything else that you remember being sort of funny?
Well, there's an interesting comment she mentioned when I brought her back a copy of her father's first pay stub from Freer.
Mm-hmm.
And she just was surprised at the low amount. And she said, and to think of that room with all the gilded furniture, which was a parlor.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So basically thinking about how underpaid her dad might have been.
Well, I don't know if he was underpaid at the time. I can't quite believe that. But
right.
Interesting. Her sensibilities maybe.
Yeah. But certainly a wealthy collector like Freer, and she felt that was...
Well, and I'm sure Freer didn't pay the top dollar, but by the same token, he paid enough to get allegiance. And clearly, Stephen was very much obliged to Freer, and the Peacock Room was the first thing to be taken out of the house.
Right.
And Stephen was very concerned about how sloppy they were in removing it and complained to Washington about that.
Right, because the Smithsonian, you had mentioned the Smithsonian sent their own movers.
Well, they actually hired a Detroit company.
They contracted someone out.
They had a person handling the dismantling of it.
Okay, and Stephen Waring, who was the curator of the collection in this house and took very good care of it, obviously, was upset about the way that they were handling it.
Well, and interestingly enough, in the Smithsonian Annual Report, it mentions or cites the fact that of all the stuff that was shipped, there were 6 railroad cars of pottery that left here. But not one thing was damaged or broken.
Amazing. Amazing. So it went via rail.
Yes.
I mean... I don't know how else it would have gone then, right?
No,
but
no planes,
okay. That is pretty incredible. So it would have been packed up, and then the rail would have picked up just right down the street here.
Or down on Fort Street.
Okay, okay. Wow, and 6 crates, you said, 6 big cars.
6 boxcars.
Boxcars.
Of just pottery.
Amazing.
Not paintings. Anything else.
Right. So Stephen was really probably responsible for how well those things were packaged.
Oh, sure.
And then he went to Washington to see their installation, to oversee that. Very interesting. Now, what was still in this house that Grace then inherited and then you inherited when Freer died?
Well, there was a chair that Freer had designed for himself that was made by the Davenport Company in Boston, a library chair, a Japanese table in green metallic finish, and a lamp, all of Freer's bedroom furniture, which was custom made for the house.
Oh, wow.
2 tables and 2 chairs from the dining room here with the same hardware.
Oh, yeah, that we're looking at right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Another small desk, a table from Stanford White, the costumer, or clothes tree.
Oh, so like the mannequin that would have been used to fit the clothing?
Mm-hmm.
Freer's clothes?
No, to hang clothes.
To hang clothes, okay. So what Freer would have used for dressing, okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, probably was in the back hall.
Oh, okay. To keep like jackets and things like that.
There's a small closet there, but
you
know, if you had more than extra people, you would need something else.
That's right, okay. So you then inherited all of those things from Grace.
And plus silver and pottery and a whole ream of Freer stationery.
Okay.
So
what was your, I mean, did you expect it for Grace to give you those things? I mean, you'd been friends for a long time.
No, but when her nephew came from South Dakota, he what was he going to do with all of that stuff? They had no place in their home in South Dakota, and shipping it back. And so I helped settle the estate after Grace died. And
oh, okay.
So.
And you were in her will, I assume, then, at that point?
No, I don't think I was in her will. I think that he just gave the stuff to me.
And she didn't have children?
No, she was never married.
But her nephew didn't have any need for it. Would have been too complicated, probably, moving it.
No, and it's this nephew that's here.
Yeah.
He's an art teacher in Spearfish, South Dakota.
Oh, okay.
It's the only nephew that she had, the only niece. She had no nieces, no nephews.
Okay. Wow. So just one. Richard Waring Hicks, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that was her nephew who then gave you the okay to keep those things.
Yes.
Do you have a particular favorite?
Well, I like the library chair. It's very comfortable.
Oh, okay. So you use these things in your own home now?
Oh, yes.
Wow. Okay. That's very interesting. So I imagine it's an interesting talking point when people come over and you can tell them that you have...
Some people, yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's fascinating. So now Freer didn't have children.
No, he was never married.
Never married. And I'm just jumping ahead a little bit. Did he have a best friend? Did he have a companion? Did he ever date? I mean, was there any indication of that in his letters that you've looked at?
I've never found any evidence of him dating, but...
Okay.
Again, there's business letters, and there are personal letters, and oftentimes personal letters were handwritten, so there'd be no copy of those.
Okay. So whoever received them?
That would be the only copy there was.
Okay. That's right. Okay.
Because in the Puyabic records, we have a handwritten note from Freer about his house he was building in the Berkshires and telling Miss Perry that unless her tiles went out over the gods, the house surely wouldn't stand. So, I mean, it's an interesting side of him to find these letters.
Mm-hmm. You mean his particularly, his close relationships with artists and maybe even other art collectors at the time?
Well, he had, of course, Catherine Rhodes was an early friend of his. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were many very beautiful women and very independent women.
Sure, yeah.
Which is kind of a whole other aspect that someone needs to explore at some time.
I agree. He was friends, the friendship that I'm aware of and have read the most about was his friendship with Agnes Meyer, who was the wife of Eugene Meyer, who owned the Washington Post in the at the turn of the century.
He was a stockbroker, too.
Stockbroker.
And he's the one that leveraged the $500,000 out of Park Davis stock for Freer to build the gallery.
Right, so big... They were both on the board of trustees, Agnes, and their names still appear in the very gallery today when you walk in. And I'm, you know, that is a very interesting thing that there seems to have not be much on. And I don't know, how would you take that if you were to, you know, write about that or think about that?
Have you read the little book that the Freer Gallery published by Agnes Meyer?
Yeah.
Which is kind of curious.
I agree.
Because when Susan was working on Freer, and I said to Susan, I said, so have you gotten a copy of his death certificate? She looked at me like, why would I want?
Right. This is Susan Hobbs. Mm-hmm. Susan Hobbs. Okay.
And I said, well, because you want to know what it says.
Sure.
And it indicates that he died of complications from syphilis.
Oh.
And Agnes Meyer makes some allusion to that, but she doesn't say it. Also, he dies at 11:30 in the morning, and when Hecker reports his death via the newspapers, he says he dies in the evening, which is kind of curious to
me. Yeah, sure.
I mean, how would you get that confused?
Right.
And I have to believe that the death certificate has the correct time on it.
Right, because the coroner would have stamped that or written that. So.
And you wouldn't make a mistake of lunchtime versus
no.
midnight.
No, probably not, huh? And so he died in New York. Were the Meyers, was Mrs. Meyer in New York when he died then?
I don't know if she was in New York or Mount Kisco.
Okay, so maybe either. Because they had the Meyers had had their vacation, their rural home in Mount Kisco. Mm-hmm. And that's actually where the Meyer children mainly grew up. Catherine Graham talks about that a lot, about her wonderful time there. But Agnes Meyer was an extremely... how could we characterize her? She was very outgoing, very independent, even though she was a woman of the times. She was married and had children, but she was also very disinterested almost in this sort of domestic and more interested in the socialite side mm-hmm. of things. So, I mean, what do we make of his friendships with these independent women, these beautiful independent socialites?
Well, she was keenly interested in Chinese art.
Okay.
So there was that connection.
Sure.
She was also very interested in Pahlavic. Mm-hmm. And they have a study collection, a very wonderful Pahlavic piece. And the Meyers came to Pahlavic Pottery in Detroit and mm-hmm. bought some stuff for Freer at one visit
okay.
in 1918.
Okay.
So, I mean, there was a collaborator, and they often bought things together and then sort of separated them between them.
Interesting.
So
definitely they had a similar aesthetic. They were sort of had their finger on the pulse of the art world. Mm-hmm. And did the Meyerses, did they go to Asia ever? Did they ever travel?
I'm sure they must have.
They must have.
I can't believe that,
okay.
that they wouldn't have.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to me that Freer's reaction and how he collected things and the way he treated living artists.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So how...
Which is highly unusual because he would always ask permission from the artists before he would lend their works for exhibition. Mm-hmm. So he didn't consider himself the owner.
That's right.
Which is unlike almost every other collector I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know another exception to that.
Okay.
I'm always looking for one, but I haven't particularly found one.
I suppose the only exception that I could think of, or someone that had a similar sort of patron-artist relationship, would be someone like Duncan Phillips, maybe, who opened up his mm-hmm. home, donated his collection, you know, as a to the public, essentially. It's a private museum, but public, open to the public. It had a similar sort of relationship where he would support artists like Arthur Dove and give them money, and then, have sort of very artist-focused. But not to the degree, I don't think, that, as you're saying, Freer was. And Freer's collection was, massive at that date
yes.
compared to the Phillips collection.
And I think the other thing that's terribly important is that Freer's collection is there for study purposes.
That's right.
And that no admission shall ever be charged.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which they're trying all the time to break.
Okay.
And Mellon and all the others studied Freer's will.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
When they were thinking of giving their collections.
Interesting.
They wanted to see what conditions he had put on it.
Okay.
The problem with Smithsonian was that they had no interest in art. They were scientific.
That's right.
And Freer's other thing was that he wasn't willing to just give them the collection.
Mm.
It was to remain in his hands during his lifetime.
Right.
Well, I'm pretty convinced that by 1901, Freer already knew that he had this issue with syphilis.
Mm.
So, for him, his lifetime, who knew how long it would,
that's
would
right.
go on.
That's right.
And the treatment for syphilis at that time was rubbing with mercury.
Oh, well, that poses
other
problems.
The hands, and So, I mean, one of the two is going to get you.
That's right.
It's just a question of when.
That's right. Okay. So he was aware that his life was coming to an end. It wasn't, his death wasn't sudden.
No, he was terribly ill before that.
And some reports I've read that he died of a stroke.
Well, but I think the death certificate sort of...
Sure.
I mean, the stroke was probably the last symptom.
Right.
Of this ongoing illness.
So the syphilis aspect is not something that visitors today that would go to the Freer House or the Freer Gallery are going to be told about.
I don't think that.
Right.
For most people, that creates more of a problem than it does.
That's right.
Answer any questions.
I agree. Certainly for us, I mean, because it leads to all sorts of questions, doesn't it? But the focus, you know, the idea that he died from a stroke, I think, leads to questions about, you know, was his lifestyle, is this, you know, very wealthy industrialist, so stressful, things like that, things that we typically associate with stroke today, but it was sounds like a symptom of a bigger problem.
Well, and when Freer and Hecker were leaving Logansport, Indiana, to come to Michigan,
mm-hmm.
He was quite ill.
Okay.
And took a trip to Quebec to just relax and recover from it.
Oh.
So that's in 1879.
Huh.
But, you know, when we say ill, I mean, I think we have a misconception of what the quality of life was at that time.
Mm, okay.
I mean, when you think of infant mortality.
Sure.
And I don't know if, I mean, I do a lot of genealogical stuff, mm-hmm. and you see maybe 15 kids and 7 of them are dead.
Yeah.
Before a year old. I mean.
It's unbelievable, right?
So, and there were no vaccines, there were no, you know,
yeah,
things that we just take for granted today.
So how would you describe then his quality of life in this house? What do we know about his daily routine, for example, or what he would have done while he was living here or not traveling, which he did frequently?
Well, his date books have a lot of information of people who would come and go, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. But he wrote them for himself.
Right.
So there's always questions.
Okay.
And many times you'll be weeks, and every day it just says Detroit, 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 nothing else.
Right. Just where he was, essentially, where he woke up that day. Now, how did he come to know the Warings?
Well, he hired Joseph Stevens Waring as his coachman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I have it in here.
Mm-hmm.
Began work for Freer on June 1, 1894.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and Stephen began to see by 1898, 97, when Freer was getting rid of his horses,
mm-hmm.
because it was just too much of a maintenance issue. And Stephen says, well, you know, my God, I better find some other use for myself here.
That's right.
I'm out of a job.
That's right.
And that's when he became a quick study of the plants and the gardens and told Freer, you know, I can take over the gardens.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened by 1899 when Freer's collection starts growing.
Right.
And then, of course, by 1906, when he gives the collection to the nation, it changes the whole thing here. And Freer has the house redone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I say redone, touching up to paint, I mean,
sure.
because people are beginning to come here.
Mm-hmm. So now who, first of all, I'm curious about who would have stayed here in terms of artists and important people during Freer's life here before there was an indication that it was going to become public before the collection would be moved and become public. Who were the people that were that would have been staying here? Because he did have a lot of guests staying in the house.
I'm not sure that there's all that many.
Oh.
His brother Richard lived here for a while in the Red Room,
mm-hmm.
at the corner. And then he brought Watson Freer here to Detroit to work for the Peninsula Car Company.
And Watson was another brother?
Was his youngest brother.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And Watson married Anna Hecker.
Oh, okay. Right next door.
Right next
door. How convenient. Okay.
And Freer built him a house right on the corner of John R.
Okay.
So, and then Watson was ill. He was always a sickly child in any case. And went back to Kingston and got a farm. And he was dead when the Freer Gallery opened. And his wife died just before it opened. So they didn't visit the gallery.
So did any of his siblings, any of his brothers visit the get a chance to visit the gallery?
No, I think all of his siblings were dead by the time he died.
And so was he when the museum opened. Okay. So as far as artists who came here, could you talk a little bit maybe about that, the artists that would have come and
stayed? Well, of course, Tryon and Doing were the primary ones. And I think this is important to come back to, too, that by December of 1889, he had pretty much settled on the house plans with Wilson Eyre. And there's a published announcement of the house to be built in Detroit in the Philadelphia paper. So the plans are dated in 1890, but it's interesting to me that this main part of the house did not change during Freer's lifetime.
Right.
And when he was designing the house, he didn't even own an oil painting yet.
So his collection really grew during the last 10, 15 years of his life.
Well, 20 years, yes.
Okay,
But the thing is that you'd think as he traveled and traveled and traveled,
right.
I mean, most people would be tempted to, with lots of money, would change the decor, but he was very content with this. And interestingly enough, I could never get Grace to come back to Freer House.
Why do you think that is?
I don't think she wanted to see anything what was in her mind.
So how do you think it was in her mind?
Well, I think the house when Freer lived here.
Yeah. And how did it look? What were the major changes between when Grace lived here and Freer lived here and when you came here for the first time in the early 70s?
Well, of course, the walls had all been painted. The paintings were gone. Until we had these reproductions put in place, no curator from the Freer had ever had any sense of where these paintings hung and the visual relationships created by them.
Right, almost like the conversations between the paintings themselves.
Because they were created as part of the architecture.
That's right.
And this border below that painting there, you see the molding that runs across, runs around. On both sides of the hall was a blue border done by Mariah Oakey Doing.
And that would have been to complement the paintings that would have hung. And the walls had a sort of they were finished, right?
Metallic finish.
A metallic finish in a variety, in different colors, in a variety of, in the different rooms.
So you can imagine with these metallic glazed walls and these ornate Stanford white frames, it must have been pretty spectacular.
Unbelievable. So when did those artists actually come and paint those paint the walls? Because they were living here at the time that they were working on the house.
Yes.
Okay, okay.
Well, they were here in 1892.
Oh, so right after the house was...
Well, Freer moves in November of 1892, and the artists come the following month.
So he had a very clear idea about, at least in terms of American artists, who he wanted to be part of. And they were young artists at the time.
Yes.
And then he actually collected their oil paintings in addition to having their hand finish on the walls. Were other people doing it at the time, having artists come and stay and paint their walls?
I don't really know of any others.
I don't either. So it's a very interesting aesthetic that he had.
And he gave them free rein.
I know, yeah.
Which, so it wasn't like he said, you know, this is kind of what I want. Although I know when he did the woodwork in the hall, and he wanted it rubbed with iron filings.
Oh.
So that as the iron would oxidize, it would change the coloration of the wood.
To a more like, to like a greenish?
Well, not so much green, but dark. The iron would rust.
Yeah, would rust. Oh, rust. Right, of course. And that would have complemented whatever metallic finish was,
yes,
in any color. It would have been just unbelievably beautiful. And so that was all painted over when Wayne stayed...
1953.
In 1953. Okay, because...
It's antiqued.
Okay, it was antiqued.
Painted green.
Oh, wow. So, because Merrill Palmer did want to keep the house from the late 1920s until the 50s. Mm-hmm. She did keep it in its original state, essentially.
Pretty much, yes.
Okay, so it was in the late 50s when Wayne State bought the
house. No, it was 1980.
Oh, so it remained as Freer had it.
But I think these metallic finishes were probably changed...
Before that. Okay. Okay.
We don't have any direct records that show us that.
Right, William has mentioned that. We're not sure when it happened.
But I'm sure they had probably water leaks or this or that, which necessitated repainting. I mean,
absolutely.
And they weren't going to spend the money to have someone try and reproduce these expensive metallic treatments.
Absolutely. Yeah, they were hand done.
I mean, he was using aluminum.
I know.
In 1892? I mean, that's...
Very expensive.
Just not heard of.
It'd be like using gold today, essentially,
yes,
right? I mean, the price of aluminum, yes, was something that most people don't know is very, very expensive. So the windowsill in the front room has little flecks of aluminum, mm-hmm, which... is really beautiful,
yes,
in contrast to those pastels. So a lot of care, and Freer had his own aesthetic, but he also had this particular relationship, based on what you're saying, that allowed artists to get as creative as they liked. He trusted them to a large degree.
Well, I think clearly they had an understanding.
Right.
I mean, I can't imagine they just said, to hell with Freer, we're going to do whatever we want.
Because
anyway,
he was living here anyways. He would have seen it, right?
But, I mean, obviously this room was modeled after Whistler's dining room, the yellow.
So this was the original dining room.
Yes.
And that door would have gone to the kitchen.
To the pantry. Which had a revolving door, so you didn't smell cooking odors.
Oh, wow. So this was original. So it's yellow today, but not the yellow that Freer would have.
This is pretty close.
Oh, it's pretty close.
We've done a careful analysis of this.
Of the underpainting.
Mm-hmm.
And it was modeled, you said, after Freer or Whistler's?
Whistler's dining room.
And where was Whistler's permanent home?
London.
Okay.
And then he had a studio in Paris.
Right.
But in 1890, Freer makes his first trip abroad to London with the purpose to call upon Whistler,
right,
and cut out the middleman in purchasing things,
mm-hmm,
because he was not happy with the price and he was not happy with the quality of stuff that he was being able to purchase.
That's right.
And there's a very interesting newspaper account of that. And if you've read the With Kindest Regards, she reproduces that article.
Yeah.
And was given before the Witenagemote Club. And the 29th of this month, I'll be speaking at the Witenagemote Club. I'm a member.
Oh, fantastic.
So I'm going to be talking about Whistler meets a wit.
Okay. So they meet in London. What do you think... I mean, he went with the express purpose of meeting Whistler, and he,
yes,
goes and meets him at his home, right?
Calls on him. You know, unannounced, and the butler comes back and says, you know, Mr. Whistler will see you in whatever minutes, and for your being a railroad man, looks at his watch. And, I mean, so they became very close friends.
Right.
And clearly Freer was Whistler's most important patron,
right,
apart from Leyland, who Whistler had already threw off.
That's right. Well, they got into that horrible fight about the peacock room. Now, Freer... did buy the Peacock Room and the Princess from the Land of Porcelain from a London art dealer. Is that right?
He bought the Princess from the Land of Porcelain first.
Okay.
He was not interested in buying the room.
Right.
Whistler's sister-in-law was the one who said, convinced Whistler Freer that he needed to buy the room. It was Mrs. Watney who owned the house, had the room taken out. She couldn't decide if she was going to sell it.
Mm.
It was for sale, then it wasn't for sale. Then it was for sale, it wasn't for sale. Finally, the gallery, Obach Gallery, was able to remove the room and reinstall it in their gallery. And they published a catalog. I have one of those catalogs from Freer.
Oh, fantastic.
With photographs of the...
So his catalog.
Yes.
Of the room before he bought it.
Yes.
Okay.
And he made a trip specially to London to reconsider, because what's he going to do with this room?
Yeah.
It's going to require a building to be built.
Right. And
where and how? And
mm-hmm.
So this is in 1904, and Stephen just has his last child born in 1904, so they're running out of space on the third floor.
Mm-hmm.
So Freer buys a room and a painting, a Whistler painting, from Obach Gallery,
mm-hmm.
with the stipulation that they not say who had bought the room.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, the newspaper, New York papers reported that J.P. Morgan had bought the room.
Ah.
And reporters were calling here to see what was happening, and Freer wouldn't give them any information.
Sure.
So that's when he gets air back, and they plan these two wings to the carriage house for the Warings to live there, and the Peacock Room, or the Blue Room, as he called it,
mm-hmm.
there.
Right. And then he brought the painting, the Princess from the Land of Porcelain, put that above the mantle.
Where
of the
it belonged.
Where it belonged, originally in the Leyland's house,
right.
in London.
Because that was there before the Peacock Room was built.
Right.
The painting was already there.
Then Whistler went through, and it was Jekyll who, an artist by the name of Jekyll, who painted the original for Leyland, and then Whistler wanted to paint a room that would complement his painting, is that right?
Well, and I think he got carried away. And,
yeah.
And the worst part was that he was inviting newspaper reporters.
His friends.
I mean, it's not a very good way to please your patron.
I don't think so. I don't think so. But Freer seems to have had a different disposition than Leyland and even other patrons like that, you know, we've mentioned, even like Henry Clay Frick, who, you know, the same, almost right around the same time as Freer died. He died just a few years later and then donated his collection. But they had a different friendship. Freer had a different understanding, I think, about the artists that he was working with.
Well, and I have to think that this idea of the educational value of the collection was always pretty paramount in Freer's mind.
Ah, okay.
Which is, in addition to the way he treated living artists,
right.
are two dynamic concepts as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. For a man of, you know, from essentially...
seventh grade education.
That's right. So interesting how the importance of education worked in his own life and also in terms of what he ended up doing with his collection. Mm-hmm. I have a quote from the Detroit Century Box. Have you ever read the Detroit
Yes.
Century Box? Where he, this Freer wrote this on New Year's Eve in 1900. And he says, "The possibilities of Detroit as a manufacturing center are immeasurable. Her excellent climate, her blue skies, her clear running waters will not change. Her educational, mechanical, and business methods will change for the better." And I thought that was interesting, and you've obviously seen this before, and that was opened up in 2000, actually. Mm-hmm. So it was 100 years between. So he wrote that on New Year's Eve, 1899, 1900, it was buried and then reopened 100 years later. So I think reading that, he wasn't from Detroit, right? He didn't grow up here. He came here for exclusively for the purposes of working and basically masterminding this Peninsular Car Company. So I think a question that a lot of people ask, and I'm sure you've heard this question many more times than I have even, is why didn't he donate his collection to the city of Detroit? And we could go several ways.
Why do you ask that question? Because the city of Detroit didn't have a museum.
Right.
The Detroit Museum of Art was privately owned until 1919.
Right. So 1885, the Detroit Museum of Art was founded over on, I believe it was Jefferson Avenue. There was a small version, and then it wasn't opened until 1927, right here on Woodward. Right. So he was long gone by then.
But Freer and Hecker each gave $10,000 to buy the land where it was built.
Did any of Freer's, because I know some of his collection was sent to other museums. It's not just in the Freer Gallery. Is any of it in the Detroit Institute of Arts?
Yes.
Okay. So there were select works that he then donated.
Which is the third point that I wanted to make.
Okay.
When Freer would dispose of things, most collectors would send them to auction or sell them through a dealer.
That's right.
And Freer did not do that. He gave them to Smith College, to Oberlin University, to Grand Rapids Library, to Detroit Public Library, as seeds for institutional collections that again could educate people.
Yeah, he was very, as you said, that really ties into this idea of spreading knowledge and appreciation for art. So paintings and, I assume,
Prints.
Okay.
Scrolls. Pottery.
So it wasn't exclusively this, I mean, the relationship between him and the Smithsonian is one, the most widely known thing about him, but in fact, based on what you're saying, is the fact that he did spread his...
Well, and you have to remember this whole concept of the mall plan with Theodore Roosevelt, and the primary person who handled that was Charles Moore from Ypsilanti, who was Freer's friend.
Right.
And Moore had interviewed Freer in 1885 and visited his small collection of graphic arts on Alfred Street.
Ah.
And later became director of the Detroit Museum of Art.
Moore did.
Yes,
he did.
Okay.
So...
In 1914.
So he's part of this sort of... Freer had his own particular aesthetic and his own particular relationships with artists, but he also had his own way of giving, I think, that was probably set apart from how other men of his
stature. And I'm sure Moore convinced Freer that, look, Washington or New York has a Metropolitan. The place for this collection is on the Mall.
Because there was no other art museum at that time.
No, there was the first museum of art.
That's right. There was no National Portrait Gallery, no American Art Museum, no National Gallery Bar, which is has a different separate board.
There wasn't even a thought for one.
No Hirshhorn, certainly. So he really did have this vision, and maybe thinking that, do you think that he thought more people would have access to it there in the nation's capital?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
I mean...
And they do, right?
Absolutely. And Stanford White would have been the architect if he hadn't been shot in 1906.
Oh, so Freer had an architect. Everything was... It wasn't like, give the Smithsonian my art and then they'll figure out a place.
No, he was very involved. Freer sketched out the plan for the galleries.
That's right.
You know,
very involved. Yeah.
But he never visited the site. He never went back to Washington after the site was selected.
Was that because he was ill, or?
Combination, I think. And the architect was a friend of Freer's from the 1890s. Had written about Italian gardens. Done much work in Michigan as well. The Alger House out in Grosse Pointe War Memorial is one of his buildings.
Yeah, that's a beautiful building, the War Memorial. Yeah. Is there anything else that you think we should talk about Freer and the house or his collection?
Well, it's interesting because I asked Grace about where the furniture was in the house that she had in her apartment.
And that you now have.
Yes, and she told me these things, and I said, well, what about the lights in the hall? And she said, well, you could never see the bulb.
So these lights right here?
Would have had beaded glass shades.
Oh, my goodness.
Covering the bulb, which would send the light off in directions.
Unbelievable.
So that you wouldn't be looking at a bare...
like we are right now.
Like we are now, yes. Yeah.
So the metalwork here, was this Yellen that did these?
Or no. George Shaw,
okay.
Philadelphia.
So there was...
Wilson Air designed them and Shaw made them.
I see. And there was some sort of... You said the beaded glass cover over the bulb.
Cup up and clip around the bulb.
Unbelievable. I mean, so really just to continue that discussion that we had about how this would have looked with the finish, right?
And it was always carpeted with oriental rugs over top.
So wood floors and then the rugs over top.
Yeah, well, it was carpeted wall to wall.
Oh, wall to wall.
Oh, yes.
So he would have the rugs cut then to fit the room?
Well, they were stitched. They were only 17 inches wide, so they had to be stitched together.
I see.
Because the looms weren't big enough to...
That's right. And those are ones that he would have brought back with him from his travels?
Well, or that he purchased in New York.
Okay. So what else did Grace say about the furniture and where it was?
Well, I should have brought that letter she sent me about it. She discussed it was all harmonious with the surroundings, and the parlor was the unusual room with that gilded furniture.
And the parlor was this first room,
yes,
right up here?
With the Dewing paintings.
With the Dewing paintings and the aluminum windowsill. So gilded furniture. And where is that furniture today?
Hecker inherited it.
Okay. So you don't have any of the gilded furniture, unfortunately, huh? And anything else that she told you about the house that you think people should know about it to sort of...
Well, interestingly enough, when Grace died, when I was taking the bed down, it was Freer's mattress that was still on the bed.
So what did you do with it?
I threw it out, of course.
Right, yeah.
I mean...
So she was sleeping on his mattress?
Yes. It was a very expensive mattress.
I can imagine it was, but probably quite old.
Well, 1892.
To 1995. But worth every penny, I suppose, if it lasted...
It was in good shape.
If it lasted 100 years. So you threw things like that away that just wouldn't have...
No, I have Freer's linens with the F inscribed on them.
And you still have those?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what do you do? I mean, do you just have them? Do you just...
Well, I use them once in a while.
Okay.
When we have some Smithsonian curators, have them to dinner, I give them a Freer napkin and Freer plate. This is dish services.
So you...
Saarinen talks about.
Oh.
With the white with a gold trim.
So you have that too?
Yes.
Okay. Like a complete dish... A complete service?
Well, there's some pieces that are gone now.
Sure. But several place settings?
Oh, yes.
Like eight place settings, something
probably
like 12,
eight,
12,
10.
So the dishes that he actually hand-selected and bought, and I imagine he probably had many different sets of dishes, but his main one, perhaps.
Yes.
And Grace got that.
Yes.
So what do you... Why do you think that he chose... Did he have nieces and nephews, Freer?
Yes. They inherited stuff. When the Japanese came, 25 years ago to do that film.
Yeah.
And the Freer Gallery was cold shoulder to them. And they were asking me, they said, well, something about Freer's will. And I said, well, I have a copy of it. So they're quite amazed with that.
That's right. That's right.
It gives all the inheritance.
So you have a copy because Grace obviously would have had a copy. Or did you get it on your own through your archives? Okay.
From the archives.
From the archives, okay. But I assume Grace knew what was going... Well, her, they would have been given to her father first,
right.
To Stephen. And then when Stephen died, gave it, left it to Grace because she was his oldest child?
Probably.
Or just...
Still living with him.
Oh, right.
And I have also a Pawabic vase about this tall that Mary Chase Berry made for Freer when he bought the Peacock Room, decorated with peacocks.
Hmm. So you have your own Freer gallery.
Yes.
So we don't really need to go to D.C. to see.
Well, I don't know about that.
No, but how incredible that you live with these things. I mean, I think that a lot of people would are maybe surprised by that or find that interesting.
Well, it's...
It's your life, though.
Yes.
How fascinating. And to go to somebody that, such as yourself that had such a deep appreciation for it and interest in Freer, I think Grace must have appreciated that as well. Hmm.
And since that time, the nephew has shipped back to me a Japanese, carved Japanese chair that was in the hall.
The front hall?
In this hall here.
Okay, yeah. Huh.
So
you have that too?
Yes.
And is, do you have enough that you need to put any of it in storage, or are you just, you have it, you've curated it on your own in your home?
Yes. I have a big enough house.
That's good. Okay. So when the Smithsonian, so you mentioned that when there's people visiting, they'll actually come to your home? And mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So there are scholars and people from...
Well, we bring them here.
You bring them here.
Because up until that time, even though two of the directors, well, actually, you know, Pope, you know, Stern came after Pope.
Mm-hmm.
But Howard Stern was from... Downriver, Michigan, who became the director after Pope. And, but, you know, there was no interest at the Freer in Freer or Detroit or, I mean, that had nothing to do with anyone there.
And do you think that that's because it was the focus... is typically now, even today, on the Asian the collection of Asian art? That
well, you think it wasn't until the 70s that Susan Hobbs became the first curator of American art. And even when she was publishing her book on the Peacock Room,
mm-hmm.
the Smithsonian said, well, your name won't appear on the book. And she fought with them until they... She got that changed, but we just don't do that. Well, that's not true.
Right. You think that because there was a sort of undermining of Western artists in relation to the Freer Gallery, just the focus was, again, on the collections of Eastern art? Why would they not want her to put her name on her book or not allow her?
Well, when Lodge... became the first director.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't too many years after that that he changed some of the galleries from Freer's scheme.
Mm.
And a lot of the American works went away.
Ah.
Because when I was there in the 70s, they still had a cabinet shop and wood, boards of wood to make cabinets out of that would match. And these were beautiful cabinets.
Okay.
And they bring some out. Linda Merrill brought some out for an exhibition. And they also have some furniture that was sent down to Washington from Freer House. Pretty much standard sorts of things, but desks and business furniture.
After he died, when the house was being cleaned out and the wiring.
And there are disposal lists of who got what and where it came from in the house.
Oh, so we do know those things. It just wasn't appreciated at the time. And like you said, two of the directors were the first two directors were from Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
That's really phenomenal. Why do you think that there's that? Is it coincidental?
Well, I think it's coincidental, yes. There are people that he knew, and because, you know, he initially had that no works could be added, and right. then later he changed the codicil that Asian art and Near Eastern art could be added
mm-hmm.
because he realized that there were being important finds coming out that were changing the way that was being viewed.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing in the American collection can
change.
Can change.
Interesting.
And nothing can travel from the gallery.
That's right.
But the study collection, the Poivik piece that Mrs. Havemeyer gave, mm-hmm. is a study collection. So those can actually travel because they're in the study collection.
Okay. Hmm.
So I have some pots, Poivik pots, that belong to Freer.
Okay.
I have a tobacco jar from 1904.
Oh.
And this Poivik pot. And so I'm going to give those to the Freer Gallery and
okay.
for their study collection.
Oh, so that they can maybe one day travel, but they will be cared for by the conservators there.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Anything else you want to talk about?
Well, I think that's about it, unless you've got some other questions you want to...
Well, there's certainly more questions, always, about Freer. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about these things.
I think the one thing you ask about his friends, you know, of course, Thomas Spencer Jerome,
mm-hmm.
whose grandfather was a governor of Michigan, lived on Alfred Street,
mm-hmm.
and in 1899, Freer buys the villa in Capri, and Jerome lives there.
Hmm. And how did he know Jerome?
From Detroit.
And Freer lived, you said, with the McLaughlins on Alfred Street
mm-hmm.
when this house was being built, essentially.
Yes.
So he met, they knew
well,
each other.
He and Jerome knew each other before. They were
before
both Witenagemot members.
Oh, okay. Which is where you're speaking mm-hmm. soon. So what do you think that was? I mean, he was just generous with his friends, and why did
well,
Jerome
I think
live there?
They were close friends, and then they have a falling out about 1906, and Freer gives the villa to Jerome.
Oh.
And he has a woman, Henrietta Rupp, who's living there, worked for him here in Detroit, and then later went to Capri, and when Jerome dies in 1914, a lot of his money and books was given to the University of Michigan, and they put on a Jerome lecture every year.
Oh.
Henrietta Rupp was kind of a problem.
She knew Jerome.
Yes, she worked for him.
Went there and lived there.
Lived with him. And she was from Michigan, and she comes back to Michigan. They finally get rid of her. She was probably having a mental breakdown
mm.
at the time. I mean, these are all research questions
that sure.
need to have someone do some work on.
I agree.
But
his many friendships, I think, with various people.
Well, a lot of Detroit Club.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
the Undertaker Club, which Freer was a founding member of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how he socialized here and
mm-hmm.
And also in D.C. and in New York too, because he had those groups as well. And the exchange, right? Like you
mm-hmm.
mentioned, the Myers would come here. He was in New York, and there was this sort of exchange because of the railroads, I imagine.
Have you read that article that Mansfield Wright
mm-hmm.
wrote about Freer, I think probably 1930,
because
mm-hmm. he's the one that introduced Freer to Whistler's
mm.
things in the 1880s. So you might want to get a hold of that.
Yeah, that's a great idea. To understand that link there.
Well, at least get a sense of it.
Mm-hmm. Right, and how that...
And of course you have to remember that when Mansfield writes this, Mm-hmm. It's after the fact. Freer's gone. There's no one to argue with him.
That's right.
So it's like when Agnes Meyer writes that little booklet.
That he died.
You know, I mean, she has her story, and I suppose that's true of all of us. We have our, as Dr. Dorsey used to say, he'd always refer to someone as my Lillian, my Thomas, my this. I remember one day I asked Dr. Dorsey, why do you do that? He said, because my Thomas and my Lillian are unlike everyone else's Thomas and Lillian.
I love that. It's true.
So, I mean, you know, that sort of have to keep that in the back of your head, too.
And everyone had their own Freer, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. So Jerome would have had a different impression
of him. Which only makes sense.
Of course. The Myers, people that lived in this house, the Warrens, yes. Everyone had their own Freer. So several books need to then be written about everyone's
Freer.
Well,
Grace told me about the morning that her father found Mr. Freer on the floor upstairs in the gallery.
Oh.
And there was always this concern because, you know, if he's gone.
Oh.
So is your livelihood.
Yeah. So a real concern for the Warrings then living here. This was it for them. Mm-hmm. This is where they live too.
And then by 1910, Freer moves him over to the house on the corner of Palmer and John R.
The Warrings?
Yes, which he owned and gave to them.
Oh, I see. So that's where Mr. and Mrs. Waring lived then, and mm-hmm. I assume died in that house.
Yes.
And then Grace moved to Indian Village. Grace was living there, probably.
Well, and then she moved up to a few blocks up the way. Mm-hmm. Drawing a blank.
North of Ferry Street. Yes. Yeah. What year did he find him on the floor? Do you remember that around that time? Or when did Freer really get sick?
It was probably after he came back from China because he became pretty sick then.
Mm-hmm. From the syphilis or from some other fever?
Well, I think from just overexertion.
Okay.
All a combination of, and who knows what he might have caught in the interior of China.
Right, all sorts of
things that were foreign to us.
Absolutely, that we today have to take medicine for before we go. Interesting. So there's many Freers that need to be mm-hmm. considered here.
And I think these three attitudes about his relationship with artists, mm-hmm. his educational value of the collection, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and the disposal of things to other institutions.
Yeah.
Are three pretty distinctive characteristics.
Right.
You might find one in another collector or an aspect of one in another collector, but those are pretty responsible sorts of attitudes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the social factors that would have impacted that, such as...
And he had no reason to be concerned about them.
Right. That's
it's
right.
Like giving the gift to the country.
That's right.
I mean, in 1904, when he first offers it, there's no income tax. There's no reason to give anything to the country.
Mm-hmm. There's no tax break. And interesting. And I wonder if his not having a wife or children, as was common for most of the industrialists that, you know, we know quite a bit about of that age, of the Gilded Age, essentially. Not that they all gave, I mean, Carnegie didn't give his children much. You know, it was that whole idea of spreading the wealth to the public. Freer certainly followed that, but in his own particular way, based on what you've said.
And, you know, he commissioned Wilson Eyre to design houses for his siblings.
Mm-hmm.
That were built in New York.
Yeah. In the Kingston area, yeah, okay. Right.
So, you know, he helped them a lot of ways, and helped his nieces and nephews. And, but he was also clever enough to realize those that weren't doing anything with their lives, and he didn't do much with them.
Yeah, so Okay, yeah. So his philanthropy was a lot about education and a lot about educating other people with what he knew about art and his travels and things like that, too. So certainly, yeah, those three things that you outline are...
And he'd always defer to someone else. I mean,
that's so interesting.
Spotlight as being an expert on anything, mm-hmm. which clearly wasn't true.
Right, because I mean, he had this the premier collection of certainly Asian art in the country, and American art. At that time there was several people, but he had a premier collection of two, you know, very vastly different places. And for him to not consider himself an expert, why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know that he didn't consider himself as being expert in some things, mm-hmm. but he just deferred to other people and mm-hmm. wasn't important. When Clara Dyer writes a thing about Mary Chase Perry and Arthur Wesley Dow was here and Morse was here and she's going to use this stuff, and Freer writes back to her, she sends him a copy of it, and Freer writes back to her that it's really of no interest what we think of her work. Her work stands on its own.
Hmm.
And I think this is part of that deference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. Lots of things that he was thinking and doing. Do you think that he was an introverted person? Or do you think that he was...
I don't think he was introverted.
Hmm.
There's a wonderful cartoon of him in the Wit books John Ward Dunmore did of Freer's The Duke of the Grand Trunk Junction. So I he was very clubbable, so.
Mm-hmm. Right. Belonged to a lot of organizations.
And eventually quit the Undertaker Club, which he formed because the members wouldn't leave business out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no business to be done there.
Right. How do you spell that? The name of that club? It's an Indian name, right?
Yondotega. Still exists.
Yondotega.
On Jefferson Avenue. With gates by Stanford White.
Huh. Hmm. And you're going to be speaking at the...
Witenagemo.
Okay. And how do you spell that?
Witenagemote.
All right. Thank you so much for taking the time.
I hope it's useful.